This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. In his first White House news conference since last May, President Bush today defended his decision to nominate White House counsel Harriet Myers to the Supreme Court. At times, the president appeared tired, at times combative, as he fielded questions from reporters, and questions about Myers dominated the event. Some of the strongest criticism of the president's choice has come from his conservative base, who are wary of Myers' unknown track record on such issues as abortion. The president said he never asked Myers about the issue.
In my interviews with any judge, I never asked their personal opinion on the subject of abortion.
In your friendship with her, you've never said
that? Not to my recollection have I ever sat down with her. What I have done is understand the type of person she is and the type of judge she will be.
President Bush speaking earlier today. A bit later in this hour, we'll be talking about the Republican Party and the challenges it's facing these days. But first, the president's press conference. Joining me now is NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. Ron, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Lynn.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Ron, did the president seem defensive to you about his choice of Harriet Myers to succeed Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court?
He was put on the defensive by the nature of the questions he was being asked, of course. When he presented her yesterday, there seemed to be a little bit of a hint that he was expecting some criticism of her, perhaps that she had not been a judge, because he mentioned, even in first introducing her yesterday, that many distinguished jurists on the Supreme Court in history have not been people with judicial experience before they joined the court. And today he seemed to be quite well prepared for some of the criticisms that he surely is aware have been leveled in the last 24 hours, the most stinging of which clearly are those that suggest that she is merely a buddy, a friend, a pal, somebody who's been close to the president's inner circle, someone he's known personally for a long time, who's helped his campaigns for office, and who has performed, in some cases, you know, something less than the most intellectual heavy lifting portion of that work, supervising the paper that comes and goes before the president on a given day, and now has the rather important and certainly not perfunctory job of being White House counsel, but a job that we still think of primarily as attached at the hip to the president as a kind of political protector. This is not the background for a Supreme Court justice that a lot of the president's strongest supporters were hoping for. They were looking for someone who was a strong intellectual force, somebody who had a strong track record on the bench, who could lead the court, help lead the court with John Roberts in a more conservative direction, do what Antonin Scalia has done mm-hmm. while he's been on the court.
Well, does this choice indicate that the president is not ready at this moment in time to take on a really tough confirmation battle in the Senate, to really take on a tough battle with Democrats over this? And does that mean that he, despite what he says, doesn't have as much political capital left as he would like to think he does?
Well, as you just suggested, of course, this morning the president, when asked about his political capital, said he had plenty and wasn't worried about how much he might have left. The president clearly made the selection he wanted to make. It's a little hard for me to see how this is a choice that he made only because he had to. I personally believe that the president could have had any qualified nominee he could defend and that Republicans in the Senate could defend. They might have had to go to some extreme measures on the Senate floor to win confirmation. What I'm talking about is if the Democrats were to filibuster. It was clear the Democrats would have filibustered some of the people that the president's core of support most would have liked to have seen appointed, a Priscilla Owen, for example, from Texas, or one of the justices from the New Orleans Circuit Court, Edith Jones or Edith Clement. There are others. The president's supporters, many of them would have liked to have seen Michael Luttig and some other people who would be more like John Roberts, perhaps demographically. At the same time, the president was interested in having a woman or a minority, but he wanted to find somebody who was close to him, somebody he felt good about, and he did not really have a strong impetus to take on resistance in the Senate. didn't want to take on the Democratic vote in the Senate, didn't want to have to break a filibuster by going to what we call the nuclear option, bring that phrase back from last spring. He would prefer to focus his attention this fall on the war in Iraq, some critical things coming up there, critical moments coming up there, on trying to do the best job we can at recovering from the Katrina, Rita, double whammy, and insofar as possible, setting the ground for next year to go back to Social Security, back to tax changing, fundamental restructuring of the tax system, and immigration. These are the issues he'd like to be talking about, and he doesn't want to expend all of that capital, plenty though there may be, on a Supreme Court fight that would necessitate breaking a filibuster. So all of that was part of his thinking in choosing Harriet Myers.
The question of Iraq did, of course, come up in today's news conference. There's been a lot in the news lately about the readiness of Iraqi forces, and the president addressed that question during today's news conference. Let's hear that tape.
Right now there are over 80 Army battalions fighting alongside coalition troops. Over 30 Iraqi Army battalions. There are over 30 Iraqi battalions in the lead. And that is substantial progress from the way the world was a year ago.
Now, Ron, last week General Casey told Congress only one Iraqi battalion is combat ready without U.S. support. Does the president's remark today contradict that, or did he just ignore that?
No, it does not contradict what the general said. The general said one battalion is ready all by itself with no U.S. support, no coalition force support. The president said, but if you count those that are ready to fight, if they have coalition support, well, the number goes way up. It goes up to 80, and 30 of them are ready to go forward in the lead with only a supporting role for coalition troops. Now, without arguing with any of these numbers, what the general said was that when it comes to functioning totally post-withdrawal, if you assume we are planning to withdraw sometime, post-withdrawal, right now, they're only at one battle-ready battalion. That's obviously a far cry from 80.
At one point, a reporter asked the president about plans for dealing with a possible avian flu epidemic, and the president's answer raised an issue that's been sort of hovering around ever since Hurricane Katrina. Let's listen to that tape.
If we had an outbreak somewhere in the United States, do we not then quarantine that part of the country, and how do you then enforce a quarantine? One thing to shut down airplanes. It's another thing to prevent people from coming in to get exposed to the avian flu. And who best to be able to effect a quarantine? One option is the use of a military that's able to plan and move.
Now, that gets back to the question of whether the role of the U.S. military should be expanded in times of domestic crisis. And that the president's brought that up a number of times in the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Why? And what is he getting at here?
Well, what happened after both hurricanes was that by the time the military got involved, when the military got involved, food and ice and water and other necessities got moved and people got rescued, and the enormous assets of the military were able to really provide what neither charities nor local governments nor state governments or even the National Guard could provide. They were highly effective. And a lot of people said, we've got to reexamine our long-standing prejudice in this country and laws that say that the military must not operate domestically. We shouldn't overrun any kind of state or local authority with the enormous power of the federal government, particularly the military. And there's a prejudice here that goes back all the way to the 18th century, really, to the earliest days of the American Revolution, and which was greatly reinforced by the experience of the Civil War and Reconstruction. People really don't want to have the military running things. Yeah. On the other hand, if we have to quarantine a city or if we have to quarantine a region of the country, that can only be accomplished by the military. And so there is a difficult question ahead for the president and the Congress and the courts to resolve.
Moving quickly to one other issue, a reporter asked the president about the ethics of accepting gifts from lobbyists, asked if it would ever be okay for a member of his administration to do so. Here's the president's answer.
You know, let me answer your question this way. It's not acceptable for any member of my administration to break the law. And I presume free gifts from lobbyists break the law. And there's all kind of reporting requirements. And I expect my people to adhere to the people that work here to adhere to what's expected of them.
Now, neither the president nor the reporter mentioned Tom DeLay, but surely that has to be the subtext here.
There were no questions today about Tom DeLay, the House Majority Leader, who has stepped aside temporarily, at least, to deal with an indictment back in Texas, which has been reissued this week in somewhat stronger form as not just conspiracy, but also laundering of campaign funds. There was no mention made of the Securities and Exchange Commission investigation now underway into Bill Frist, who is the Senate Majority Leader. So the House Majority Leader, the Senate Majority Leader, both under some cloud, although, of course, Mr. DeLay's situation appears to be far more serious. And no mention, really, I shouldn't say no mention, because there were two questions that attempted to have the president discuss the matter of Karl Rove and Louis Libby, who are top aides to the president and the vice president, respectively, and who are involved in the Valerie Plame CIA agent identity leak case, which may be coming to a head in the days and weeks ahead as the special prosecutor wraps up his investigation of those matters. The president just said, I can't talk about that. I told the special prosecutor I wouldn't and I won't. So the president did not. None of that came up in today's news conference. The reporters who work in the White House tend to be focused on a set of issues that are relevant to their daily briefings, that are relevant to what goes on in the White House. They're certainly aware of all the political things that are going on in the country, all the political ramifications of everything that happens in the White House. They read polls, they read newspapers, they're aware of the outside world, but they're focused on the matters that they have to deal with. So many of the questions that many watchers, listeners, readers might have did not come up at this news conference.
We're going to focus on some of the problems facing the Republican Party in the next segment, but quickly before you have to leave, Ron, how bad do things look for the GOP, do you think? Have reports of their imminent collapse been greatly exaggerated?
They aren't really in danger of imminent collapse. What is going on is that after 11 years in power in Congress and having the House that whole time and the Senate most of that time, and having the presidency since 2001, they have become the party in power. So when anything goes wrong, whether it's the war and war fatigue, or whether it's Katrina and the response to that, it's all going to be laid at their feet, and they're experiencing some of the deterioration that inevitably comes with power.
Thanks, Ron. Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor. He joined us here in 3A. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. All 435 members of the House of Representatives must reapply for their jobs every 2 years. In 1994, this worked to the Republicans' advantage as the longtime minority party swept into power with a rallying cry of smaller and cleaner government. Just over a decade later, the Democrats are hoping to return the favor. Many conservatives are concerned about the delay effect, as well as public attitudes about the response to Hurricane Katrina, rising gas prices, and the ongoing war in Iraq. Joining us now in Studio 3A is Matthew Continetti. He's a reporter at the Weekly Standard. Welcome. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what's your take on the Republican Party these days? Is it losing its way?
It's come under a rough patch. There's no doubt about that. It's ironic to me that last week, when Tom DeLay was indicted, was the 11th anniversary of the Contract with America, the unveiling of that. And there, 11 years ago, the GOP promised to drain the swamp that was Washington and lead a new era of conservative governance. And now they find themselves up to their necks in the muck. The question is whether they can move beyond it and whether they can go to the country next year with a set of issues that the public is sympathetic to their position on. And I think that's entirely possible. But what is key, though, is that these scandal stories aren't about to go away anytime soon.
How did the Republicans get into this position up to their necks in the muck? Where have they gone wrong, in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, it was allying themselves too closely with the business industry, which was always a part of the Republican coalition. But when the Republicans came into power, they realized that the way to remain in power was to ally themselves with the lobbyists on K Street. And so they enacted this strategy, what came to be called the K Street Project, bringing in donations from the lobbyists and the companies that the lobbyists represent, and shaping the culture of lobbying so that it's more GOP-oriented. It used to be democratically oriented simply because the Democrats were in power for 40 years. Well, that put the conservatives and some conservative lawmakers, they started rubbing shoulders with some pretty sleazy characters. And the foremost of those, of course, is the lobbyist Jack Abramoff, who's the subject of an investigation that now in its 18th month, it's had its first arrest in the course of that investigation a few weeks ago, the White House procurement director, David Safavian. This is an investigation that won't be going away anytime soon and really threatens the careers and the reputations of a lot of the prominent conservatives in Washington. Tom DeLay, actually the least among them, you know, he's certainly very powerful and whatnot, but he won't be in a year from now.
We're talking about some of the political problems facing the Republican Party right now. We'd like to hear from you. We'd especially like to hear from Republicans in the audience, and we know you're out there. What do you think about the direction your party's going in? What are your concerns? Give us a call here. The number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and you can send an email to totn@npr.org. And my guest right now is Matthew Continetti. He's a reporter at the Weekly Standard. Matthew, I just want to follow up on what you were just saying because, you know, Congressman DeLay certainly in the last few days has not seemed apologetic at all about his relationship with a lobbyist like Mr. Abramoff.
Sure. And there's two issues here, of course. The indictments for Tom DeLay that have happened in the past 2 weeks are a totally separate matter. They're not related to the investigation of Abramoff. They're not related to the K Street Project in a marginal way. This is Ronnie Earl's indictments for this fundraising scam that seems to have occurred out in Texas. And so DeLay hasn't been forced to answer many questions about Abramoff, someone who he's called one of his best friends in Washington. He's been focusing on the Earl investigation. I actually think the Earl investigation and the indictments there is a sideshow. I've seen
the more important case is the Abramoff case.
Absolutely.
And could cause more political problems not only for Mr. DeLay but for other members of the
Republican Party. I agree. I mean, you know, other lawmakers such as Bob Ney, another of these crusaders from 1994, he's involved. Senator Conrad Burns is touched by Abramoff. It's kind of scary sounding, the touch of Abramoff, but I think it may become a real issue in the midterm election.
This is not the only problem facing the Republican Party.
Sure.
What about Iraq? There's certainly concern out there in the country about the role the U.S. is playing in Iraq, whether we should stay there or not. How difficult is that making life for Republicans?
Well, I think when you talk to lawmakers, they do say that they're hearing about their constituents, about how the war is being conducted. They're also hearing about immigration, and they're hearing a lot about the gas prices, of course. When people are talking about their concerns with the Iraq war, it's not so much why we're there. It's how the war is being fought. They don't see many victories, and the public needs to see more victories in the war in Iraq. If they don't see those victories, if they don't have a sense that we're winning and the terrorists are losing in the midterm elections, that's a pretty bad landscape for Republicans to be in. Now, there's a debate among some parts of the party. Some conservatives think that we need to be looking, as Grover Norquist put it, Iraq needs to be in the rearview mirror heading into the midterms. That I don't think that idea has catched on with many Republican congressmen. I think the GOP understands the importance of the war on terror. They think that Iraq is part of the war on terror. They would like the president to stress that argument a little more than he has.
We're talking about some of the political problems facing the Republican Party, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. Let's go to Andrea in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Andrea.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. I think my connection's off. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very clearly.
I'm calling because you said that you would like to hear from some Republicans about what we think about our party right now. And as a Southern Christian Republican, I am horrified at my political party. And I just don't understand how they've been able to get away with mixing so much religion and the business community in with politics. And it's just really kind of gotten very painful for me to watch what's happening in Washington. And I'm just kind of curious why so much religion and so much of the business world is allowed to be intermingled with politics right now.
I'm curious, Andrew, because you identified yourself as a Christian. So you say you're a Christian, but you're concerned about the intersection of religion and politics and business?
Oh, very much so. I'm a very strong Christian, but I know I think it's very important to keep religion and politics separate, because I feel like that can just be really dangerous. Religion is a wonderful thing for me in my life, but I personally don't feel like it needs to be mixed with politics. I just think it becomes somewhat of a dangerous combination.
All right, I'm going to ask our guest to respond to your concerns. Thanks, Andrea.
What strikes me about the caller is that she's not alone. I've been following the Abramoff investigations for months now. I'm writing a book on the subject of the GOP's troubles, published in several newspapers, articles related to this topic. And each time that I write something about this, I get letters from Republicans who share my concerns. They're saying, well, you know, something has happened to the conservative movement. It's become too comfortable with power. It's become too bloated to kind of contain its excesses. I think that should be a big concern for Republicans.
And what about the question of religion? And is there a divide within the party between what you might call the values conservatives or the religious conservatives versus the economic conservatives, the fiscal conservatives?
Sure, definitely. I think you can see with the Supreme Court pick, Harriet Myers. This is someone who, she is a devout Christian, but she's someone who will definitely please the business community, more probably so than she will social conservatives. There's always a tension between social conservatives and the business lobby. And I think that social conservatives are just beginning to realize that in the end, the business community matters a little bit more to the GOP establishment.
Yeah, and what does that mean then?
Well, that means that the social conservatives may not come out to vote in 2006 and 2008 in the same way that they have in the past, which would cause a major electoral loss for the Republicans.
You think that's really a possibility?
Oh, sure it is.
They're not likely to become Democrats. They're just likely not to come out and vote.
If you look at the polls, what's happening to the president's approval rating, one of the reasons the White House has been concerned in recent weeks, is that Democrats have basically made up their mind about President Bush for a long time. They don't like him. But Republicans really do like him. But just now, part of that Republican base, you know, to use the jargon, has started to slip away. They've become dislodged, in the words of one pollster. They're independent-minded. They probably voted for Perot in 1992, but they became Republican over the past 10 years because they thought Republicans were going to reform Washington. And now they're looking around, and they're not pleased with the president in Iraq, or they're upset at his response to Hurricane Katrina. And so they're just becoming dislodged. And that doesn't work. That doesn't bode well at all for the GOP.
All right, let's take a call from Tony. And Tony is calling from Lake Worth, Florida. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi. This last election, I voted Republican for the first time in my life. I'm 40 years old, have four children. Getting more conservative the older I get. And I find what the gentleman is saying just absolutely ludicrous, because there's a silent majority out there that, at parties, I would hear people, oh, Bush is going to get crushed, the polls say this, the polls say that. And there was such a vocal few that we didn't say anything. I just kept my mouth shut because if I said something, I'd get yelled at. And we voted. And for him to think that people like me, we have no alternative. We can't go to the Democratic Party because it's so liberal and their social views and agenda are so off that we don't want our children raised the way they're professing. And that's why more and more people are becoming more conservative. And when it comes to the Republican Party having problems right now, I don't see a problem. I see there's a few, but we have no alternative other than to keep on voting Republican in this way. I think that he's way off when he thinks, oh, they're just not going to vote. We don't like what's going on in Iraq, but we have to stay the course. Both my nephews are over there right now. I don't want them to die. We don't want them there, but we have no choice at this point. And the Democrats, what they'll do is they'll pull them out. We know that that's the wrong thing to do.
All right, let me hear what I'd really like Matthew Continetti to respond to what you're saying.
No, look, I mean, I voted for Bush in the last election, of course, because I supported his policies in Iraq and the war on terror, and because I wanted him to nominate conservative Supreme Court justices, and I wanted to keep taxes low. So there's a huge umbrella of agenda items that keep people in the conservative column. What I'm saying is that the GOP doesn't need to, can still lose elections without voters becoming Democrats. They just, if those voters don't vote, they're still going to lose elections. I mean, look how Bill Clinton was elected president in 1992 with 43% of the vote. It's not a majority by any means, but he still became president.
The social conservatives, though, they're the most activist people there are. There's no way they're not going to sit there and let the alternative take control. There's no way that's going to happen, no matter how unhappy they are or how they feel. It's just not going to happen that way. I think you're wrong.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Tony.
Sure.
Okay. I just wanted to remind our listeners that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Jim Leach. He's a Republican congressman from Iowa's 2nd District, and he joins us from Capitol Hill. Thanks for being with us, Congressman Leach.
Well, good to be with you, Lynn.
Now, a recent Washington Post ABC News poll showed that only 37% of Americans approve of the way Congress is doing its job. How concerned are you about this as you're heading toward the 2006 election year?
Well, I don't look at it as much as a congressional issue as I do what it means for the country. Things aren't going well in many given different directions, and the Congress is not rising to the occasion to the degree maybe it should. And so I think there's got to be a lot of rethinking and a lot of reassessment of what's right and wrong, both public policy and in behavior.
Do you think there is a growing rift within the Republican Party? And if so, how would you characterize the divisions?
Well, there are always divisions within any political party. When you have only two major political party and a growing number of issues, I mean, in the thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, there are always going to be differences of judgment, and that's fine. The question is not so much whether there are divisions, but whether there can be a decent way of handling the divisions and whether there can be a decency in American politics between the political parties, and that is why this word comity has come into the fore so greatly recently. The feelings of trust, the feelings of respect are breaking down between the parties and slightly within, but mainly between.
Given that there's always some divisions, political divisions within a party, I guess what I'm really trying to get at is, are the divisions fairly serious within your party right now as a result of some of the things we've been talking about, the questions about possible questions of corruption and ethical breaches of ethics, and also on issues of fiscal responsibility? A number of conservative Republicans are worried about the direction the party's heading in terms of the spending of government money.
Well, the interesting thing is on the first issue, and it's a very serious one, the issue of ethics, it is the one area of public policy that there shouldn't be compromise. I mean, many areas of public policy, you have to get middle grounds or at least reasonable consensus approaches. On ethics, I think there's a case for a lack of compromise, and no political party should tolerate indulgences and excessive ethics abridgments. And so in general, the attention in my time in public life is always a little bit centered on whatever the majority party is, but it's a problem in governance. And we all know Lord Acton's dictum that power corrupts and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. And the issue is really how you handle it. And I think it's important that ethical lapses be handled forthrightly and be dealt with.
Well, there's a group of 100 conservative House members called the Republican Study Committee, and they've put forth a plan known as Operation Offset. Would you agree with certain tactics, returning pork barrel projects, like to pay for Hurricane Katrina relief? I mean, is that the right direction to go in, or would you even consider tax cuts?
Well, I think
Would you go ahead with the tax cuts?
Sure.
Is what I mean.
I think the party's going to have to consider timing of tax cuts as well as argument for tax cuts. And to conduct a war and to deal with natural disasters with very steep tax cuts obviously raises questions of judgment. In terms of the offsets of what we describe as pork, I come from the country's largest pork-producing state, and these are hogs. And in Iowa, we think the Congress is giving our state a bad name. but the The notion that $24 billion of specially designated projects in a highway bill were put into the bill is something that should raise eyebrows, particularly...
Congressman Leach, we have to take a break
Thank
now.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, honored to be with you.
Jim Leach is a Republican congressman from Iowa's 2nd District. He joined us from Capitol Hill. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Today we're talking about the Republican Party, and we especially want to hear from Republicans in our audience. Join the conversation. Call us at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And my guest is Matthew Continetti, a reporter at the Weekly Standard. And we're going to take a call now from Chris in Central Valley, California. Go ahead, Chris.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, really love your show. It's a really great balance to a lot of the conservative things I mostly listen to. But my main complaint against the Republican Party, being I voted for Reagan in 84 starting out, is that the ideas of religion and the ideas of what I see as true republicanism have been so, they've moved away from that so much, in the sense that by aligning themselves with businesses, they have left themselves wide open to so many unethical situations. And from a Christian perspective, when you look, when I read the Bible, I look at it as a call to help the poor, help the sick, and I do not see that in the policies of the government. And I see that in the face of facts, even from within their own party, government agencies talking about how, blacks, Hispanics are being terribly underserved. Even before Katrina, they just don't want to look at the evidence of that. And so for me personally, it drives me to the point of where I'm looking for independent third-party candidates, because I don't see as much fiscally responsible behavior coming from the Democrats, an example being both Democrats and Republicans got a lot of pork in the transportation bill. It wasn't just Republicans. So I'm sort of in a point where I'm looking for something in a third-party candidate, because I don't see the Republicans acting like Republicans.
All right. Chris, very interesting point. Let me just ask Matthew Continetti to respond to that first. Interesting what he's bringing up, which is that some of the conservative base, that is the social conservatives, religious conservatives, perhaps being very turned off by these ethical questions, these problems of corruption that we've been talking about.
Absolutely. And the caller raises an interesting issue as well, if spending, the size of government. And the numbers have just come out, and we know that government has grown under George W. Bush faster than it did under Lyndon Baines Johnson. Bush isn't really a Reagan conservative when it comes to spending. He's a Johnson conservative, which strikes me and many other conservatives as very odd and disturbing. I think there's going to be a big schism in the party going into the 08 presidential race, where candidates are going to have to align themselves either with the Bush legacy on spending, or they're going to try to ally themselves more with Reagan. The question is, who's going to run as Reagan? Who's going to say, I'm going to constrain the size of government in a way that the president failed to do, President Bush failed to do?
If I can make a point on that, when I get together with people in Central Valley, many of them business owners, we look at how the government has been run from the Bushes from a business perspective. And when in terms of not just hiring, the whole Michael Brown incident, but in terms of economic policies, I would kick George Bush back to the mailroom. I mean, the decisions really do not seem to come from research. They do not seem to come from really thinking ahead how the policies that are decided upon now affect the business climate in the future. And I'll take that answer offline. But thank you again very much. Great show.
Chris, thanks so much for your call. And standing by now is Lynn Westmoreland, a Republican congressman from Georgia's 8th District and a member of that Republican study committee that we mentioned earlier. And he is joining us by phone from Noonan, Georgia. Thanks so much for being with us, Congressman Westmoreland.
Well, having me.
Now, I don't know if you just heard our last caller, but I thought it was interesting, and I'd like to hear your response. But he was a Republican expressing concerns that the party is leaving behind its ideals in terms of religious values and also just in terms of some of the ethical questions that have been raised and in terms of not doing enough about making the government smaller, about spending and big government.
Well, I hear that, you know, from the base here. I'm in a very conservative district, and, you know, those are some issues that were brought up on the campaign, like, you know, why are we doing all this spending? In fact, you know, and I love President Bush, and, you know, I'm glad he's there rather than John Kerry. But, you know, if you look at what one of the callers mentioned, Lyndon Johnson, he realized that there was a problem with poverty and seniors, a growing senior population, and he just threw money at it. And that will probably be the thing that ends up breaking this country is the Medicaid and the Medicare and all the social programs that we've got. And it seems like that we are in that same path of just trying to throw money at problems. And, you know, these are real-world problems that people have, and we're addressing them with political answers.
Yeah. Do you feel your party leadership is listening to what you're saying and would respond to calls for spending cuts?
I hope they are. They seem to be. And, you know, the Republican Study Committee, we put together a package that would cut about $600 billion over the next 10 years out of government. And, you know, the federal government, for some reason, sometimes feels like our tax dollars is play money, monopoly money. And, you know, if you've got a dollar to spend, then you've got to make some decisions on what you spend it on. You can go into the store and say, well, you know, do I need a loaf of bread or do I need a gallon of milk or whatever? And the problem with the government is that we go in with a dollar and buy both of them.
Do you think the party can go ahead with tax cuts at a time when you've got to pay for both a war and the huge cost of hurricane relief?
Well, I do. I think the tax cuts proved that they were the right economic stimulus that we needed in this country this year. You know, the deficit was decreased by about $94 billion. And so the tax cuts have got the economy stimulated. It's not the size of the tax cuts. To me, is the fact that, you know, we're just spending too much money. And the reality of it is that, you know, if you don't control spending, you can never collect enough money. And, you know, we need to be doing things that encourage entrepreneurs, encourage businesses, encourage people to be self-dependent, self-reliant, and not be so reliant on the government. Government's job is not to look after our personal responsibility. That's individuals' jobs. And that's the real problem that I see that we're facing, because we're trying to address those problems with money, and that's not the way you do it.
Yeah. Just one other question, and that is the problems that Tom DeLay is facing right now, the questions being raised about relationships between members of Congress and lobbyists, and again, going back to that caller who said these kinds of things are a concern to him in the sense that it seems to him that they indicate that the party is losing its way in terms of its the ideals that have brought a certain kind of voter into their fold.
Well, you know, the thing about Mr. DeLay is that, you know, when he collected that money, he filed a campaign finance report that said he collected it. When he gave that money to the RNC or the NRCC, they reported that they got it. And then when they spent it, they reported that they had spent the money. And so, you know, everything was done legally as far as filing the campaign finance report, collecting the money. And, you know, I don't know, you know, if you file all the reports right and then you can still be indicted for money laundering and conspiracy, that there's a problem somewhere. There's a problem in the system. And what we've done with campaign finance reform, you know, here again, we've passed laws to try to make people honest. And that's just, you know, that doesn't work. And, you know, I believe in the full disclosure and let people be part of the system. We've got these 527 groups and other ways that people funnel money And, you know, it does. It gives off a bad image for everybody. And yet, you know, really and truly, I hate to say this, but I'm probably guilty of some type of violation, but I don't know about it. I think I'm legal. I mean, you know, we've done everything according to the law, but that the campaign finance, that thing is so gray and so broad, it's hard to understand what the stuff really means.
Right. Okay, thanks so much, Congressman Westmoreland.
No, thank you for having me, and I appreciate your show and appreciate the comments that I've heard. So right. Thank you very much.
Lynn Westmoreland is a Republican congressman from Georgia's 8th District and a member of the Republican Study Committee. And he joined us by phone from Noonan, Georgia. And joining us now is Congressman Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader of the House of Representatives. Congresswoman Pelosi, we've been hearing from Republicans about some of the issues that their party is facing now. How can Democrats take advantage of this moment?
Well, first of all, we have to act in the public interest, and that's a drastic difference from what the Republicans are doing. First, let me say hello, Lynn. It's wonderful to join you. I'm here at the Capitol, where we are. Some are observing the holy days, and others up there getting ready for their return.
Good to have you on the show.
Thank you. When they get back, we will be taking up an energy bill, and that gives us an opportunity to differentiate from the Republicans. We have an energy bill which once again is a back-to-the-future kind of bill that does not take us into the next, not only into the century we're in. So we look forward to conveying to the American people Democratic proposals for how we can be energy independent in the next 10 years. And that kind of timetable will bring to health care. We think in 5 years we could make sure that every American has access to health insurance in our country. We are very pleased that Democrats were united and are united in fighting the president's proposal on privatization of Social Security to the point that now Republicans are saying it probably won't be brought up, but we will continue to have that fight. We are putting forth our agenda on innovation to create jobs, again, to have goals of having in 10 years a broadband in every household in America, 100% across the country. That will create jobs, that will help children learn at home, and that takes us to education, where we want to have every child having opportunity to go to college without going deeply into debt, and also not leaving any children behind by severely underfunding No Child Left Behind. Let me just make one point about education and spending. Education is an investment. And every dollar spent on education, whether it's early childhood, K through 12, higher ed, post-grad, lifetime learning, brings money into the treasury and grows the economy. So that is an investment that it has a high return to our system.
Congresswoman Pelosi, I just need to remind our listeners that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And as you do that, I will take us to the budget, where we talk about education bringing return to the Treasury. Right now we have a budget situation that is really immoral in terms of the priorities in the budget, which do not address the needs of the American people, and also immoral on how it heaps mountains of debt onto future generations by driving us into debt. Democrats have always stood for pay-as-you-go, no deficit spending. We know how to balance the budget. We had surpluses in the last 3 years of the Clinton administration, and of course that was all reversed when President Bush came in with his tax cuts for benefiting largely the wealthiest people in our country.
All right, Congresswoman Pelosi, we want to get to a caller right now. We have Peter in Ohio calling. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you? Great show.
Good, go ahead.
I was just going to say, going back to some of the previous comments, that I think social conservatives will turn out for the Republican Party in 2006. I know it's a lost step with what you're talking about with Congressman Pelosi right now, but I think that it used to be an all-or-nothing game for the social conservatives. If the candidate wasn't 100% perfect in their eyes, they might indeed stay home in large numbers, but I think they become a lot more politically savvy. And I think, as bruised the Republican Party may appear right now, at least in the mainstream media, it's a much better choice than the Democratic Party has put forth in the last 20 years at least.
No, what?
I'm sorry, say that again?
I think that the Republican Party is still a much better choice for social conservatives than the Democrats have put forth in the last 20 years at least. I think the social conservatives will turn out in 2006.
Okay, thanks for your call, Peter. I want to raise a question with you, Congresswoman Pelosi. A number of people, a number of commentaries that I've read recently have been saying that while there are some serious problems in the Republican Party, the Democratic Party has really done not been able to really create a vision that people understand where they're going. They've been very critical of the Republicans without really offering a clear alternative for voters. And something that we've heard people say here today is they may be disgruntled with the Republicans, but they might look for a third party. How can the Democrats try and woo people over to their party at this moment?
Well, first of all, let me say this. I will continue to be critical of the Republicans as long as they operate in a culture of corruption and cronyism at the expense of the American taxpayer, the American...
But beyond being critical,
yeah,
I certainly...
I will continue to... that is a decision to be critical of them, and it isn't because of any lack of ideas about where we would go forward. It was important for us because we are in the minority and because, and not to... complain about this, but it is a fact that we are not allowed to bring any alternatives to the floor of the House of Representatives for us to leapfrog out of Washington to have our own venues to go forth with our vision that is about energy independence, which is about access to health care for all Americans, about educating our children, leaving none behind, and giving an opportunity for education to all Americans who young people who want that, to have a budget that is in balance both in values and in terms of dollars, and we will do that. But it was important for us to show a differentiation and to point out what is happening in Washington, D.C. in a way that showed a difference between the two parties. I am very proud of the Democrats in the Congress. I'll agree with you that our message is not coming forth from the Congress because we don't have a platform to do it here. But that's not, you know, that's not reason enough for the American people not to hear from us. I think that in the next few months, as we come out of Katrina, you will see a strong vision put forth by the Democrats. We had put forth our new Partnership for America's Future, where many more Americans participate in the economic success of our country, where national security is with a military second to none, with diplomacy to keep the peace, where we never again send our troops into war without the equipment that they need to do their jobs and come home, where we have protect our civil liberties as we protect the American people.
Ms. Pelosi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is a Democratic congresswoman from California's 8th District. And I also want to thank my other guest, Matthew Continetti, reporter at the Weekly Standard.
Thank you.
This is Talk the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.